Okay, so good afternoon. This is Bio 241. It's January 28th and it's Wednesday. I'm gonna go back and do the chemistry flash quiz fairly quick. Maybe I'll go through it not so fast the first time, but then a couple times really, really fast. All right, unless I hear a resounding no, don't do that. Should we do it or forget doing it? Go for it. Let's do it. Okay, wait, I gotta get my mouse back. Shortcut to travel drive. How interesting. Is it over here? Yeah, here it is. Sorry. It's like giving an IV to the computer. Okay. So go ahead and take a look at the screen. Is that light too bright? Can you see the screen okay? Good enough? Okay. All right, so let's take a look at this before I switch. It's a nucleotide. What kind of nucleotide? Ribonucleotide, because there's the oxygen, so that's a ribo sugar. All right, and this is a sulfhydryl group. And this is an amino group and a carboxyl group that makes that an acidic molecule and phosphate group that makes this molecule partly soluble in water because you get a lot of charged ions off of this thing right here. And then a monosaccharide, and this, why does this dissolve in water very nicely? Look at all these, look at all these oxygens here. Right, they form polar covalent bonds, so it dissolves in water very, very easily. And a saturated fatty acid and triglyceride formation or dehydration synthesis reaction, or you could say, oh, I see a glycerol and three fatty acids making this triglyceride. Various ways we can think about that. Another monosaccharide and a micelle. It's like an artificial cell because those phospholipid molecules just line up just like that, yeah? No. If it's glucose or fructose or whatever, no. No. Just know it's a monosaccharide. And that, if you put them together, what do you get? Disaccharide or polysaccharide or something like that, right? So I just want you to know that a monosaccharide is the building block of a polysaccharide. And actually, a monosaccharide is a building block of a nucleotide as well. Sort of interesting, okay? And these are steroids. Some are hormones. So the top one is just cholesterol. And then an unsaturated fatty acid and amino acid, right? Because here's the carboxyl group, here's the amino group, and then this is the variable side chain right here. This is a building block of a protein. Okay, here is phospholipid. That's a basic building block of a membrane, of the membrane, phospholipid bilayer. And these are signaling molecules called prostaglandins. Oops. And this is alpha helix. What's the building block of, or secondary structure? Yeah? What's the building block of secondary structure?
Primary
structure. And what does the alpha helix contribute to? What is it? What is it a building block of? Does that make sense? I think so. It's a building block of tertiary structure. Okay, tertiary structure. Which is what? The overall three-dimensional shape of a protein. And why is that important? Why is the overall three-dimensional shape of a protein important? You don't know this yet. You're just kind of saying it because I'm telling you to say it. You'll see why it's important in a little bit. Because the shape of a protein determines its function. Right. Structural functional relationship. All right. And here is a deoxyribonucleotide. Right, so it's missing this oxygen on the ribose, so that's a deoxyribose, not just a ribose sugar. Don't forget this is a 5-carbon sugar. What is this a building block of? DNA. Yeah, DNA. Oh, do you know the bases that are allowed in DNA and the base pair rules? Say the base pair rules in DNA.
Binding and adenine.
Okay, TA or AT and GC. That's how I say it. If you want to say it backwards, that's fine. Doesn't matter. Right. Okay. And this is hydroxyl group, glycerol, another phospholipid, carbonyl group. All right, this is where we started. So I could go backwards, but I'll go forward. Okay, so let's see if you can see this thing real quickly. Ready? Sulfhydryl group, amino group, carboxyl group, phosphate group, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid, triglyceride formation. Oh yeah, dehydration synthesis. You should probably know that on the tip of your tongue. Monosaccharide, micelle, steroids, unsaturated fatty acid, amino acid, phospholipid, prostaglandin, alpha helix, or you could say secondary structure, deoxyribonucleotide, yeah, hydroxyl group, glycerol, phospholipid, carbonyl group, ribonucleotide. What is it a building block of?
RNA.
That's right, RNA. Okay. And as a matter of fact, when you see all those little chemicals, you should think, what are they a building block of? What is used, what does your body use them for to make something bigger? And what kind of reaction does it use? And maybe you can even break them down into simpler things. Like phospholipid, what is it a building block of? The cell membrane. All membranes, right? Even all organelles inside the cell that have a membrane around them. Yeah. Okay, let's take a look. So here is a nucleotide. It's a ribonucleotide. This is the building block of RNA. Ribonucleotide, because there's a sugar right here. I mean, there's an oxygen right here. Now, if there is no oxygen in this position, but this carbon simply bound to the hydrogen, that's called a deoxyribonucleotide. And that's where DNA comes from. The deoxy in DNA comes because this is a deoxyribonucleotide. So this right here, as you see on the screen, this is a building block of RNA. If it's missing the oxygen, it would be a building block of DNA. All right, so that's not a major difference in this molecule, but in your body, it's a huge change. All right, okay. All right, so the building block of RNA and DNA are the same. There's really only a little change in this one, oxygen, and maybe the base pairing rules. Did we go over the base pairing rules for RNA? I think. Let's start with DNA again. What are the base pairing rules for DNA? They're? Yeah, GC and AT. All right, we all say a little bit differently. What are the base pair rules for RNA?
AU.
AU and GC. So GC is the same as in DNA, but there's no thymine in RNA. All right, so I can go over this again next week unless you're really bored with it. And I think I have it as a little video online.
Yeah.
You can practice it. Okay. All right. Okay. So I'd like to use those things. You can cover a lot of ground in a hurry. All right, so I think we're here at this slide. Are we here? No? Here? Gene expression? Oh, before. Right here. This slide. Okay. All right, I can start here. It's even the slide before this one. Like this one here? Okay, this is a secretory process, right, or secretory pathway. Well, let's just review for fun. What's the organelle that's responsible for making proteins?
Ribosome,
that's right. And the ribosome can be a free ribosome, like I see in the cytoplasm here. Oh, here's a free ribosome right here. Or it can be attached to rough endoplasmic reticulum, so the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is protein synthesis, right? All right, the fate. What's the fate of a protein made by rough endoplasmic reticulum? Where does it end up?
Golgi.
Okay, it goes to the Golgi. And then where does it go?
Secreted.
Okay, then into a vesicle, and it could stay in that vesicle, trapped in the vesicle inside that cell. Or if that vesicle gets shipped over to the plasma membrane, it's going to be secreted outside the cell. Okay, so proteins that are made by endoplasmic reticulum, probably most of them end up outside the cell. But in any case, they never end up floating around in the cytosol, because they're always going to be membrane bound or trapped within some kind of membranous structure, like the Golgi apparatus or the secretory vesicle, or for instance, even a lysosome. Okay, so function of rough ER is protein synthesis, function of Golgi apparatus is, yeah, and maybe even say modifying that protein that it gets from the rough ER and packages it into some kind of vesicle, maybe for secretion, or maybe for staying inside the cell. And what's the function of free ribosomes? Like this one right here. Produce proteins? But what's the fate of those proteins? Yeah, they just wander around inside the cytosol all the time, doing whatever they're supposed to do. But they don't leave the cell, right? They stay inside the cell within the cytosol. Okay, so what else should we know? Lysosome, function of lysosome. Digestive system. There's another vesicle inside the cell, which I don't necessarily see right here, but it's a peroxisome. What's the function of peroxisome? Detoxification. All right, so you should have some bullet points of all the organelles, what they do inside the cell. Right? And so I might show you a picture of the cell, because that's an exam figure, and it's labeled mitochondria, nucleus, all that kind of stuff, but that's pretty boring. On the test, I might ask you, match it with a function. Right, so you should match up the shape of that organelle with the function, whatever it does, inside the cell. Okay, all right, so... All right, so here we are, nucleus. That's important. Here's the nuclear envelope. You can see it's a double membrane structure. So it's very difficult for things to move from the nucleus back into the cytoplasm, or vice versa. But that's really the job of the nuclear envelope, is to protect the DNA from things that are happening in the cytoplasm. The DNA, or information in chromosomes, is the only link to life that a cell has. The information on how to build the cell and how a cell will function is contained within this DNA right here. So you could think of all the information in the DNA or chromosomes as like a computer program. And what happens to a computer program if it gets corrupted, if it loses some information in the program? Right? Then that computer program doesn't work anymore. And if it's the program that runs the cell, then that cell is going to die. If it's a computer program on your computer, what choices might you have? Yeah, you could maybe close the program down, reboot it, maybe it will start up again, but if it doesn't, then you have to erase it from your computer and then reload the computer program. Well, we don't know how to reload information into the nucleus yet, but that would be fascinating. Medicine will get there. It's called genetic techniques, right? But if that information is destroyed, that cell is destroyed or becomes abnormal, maybe a cancerous cell, for instance. All right. Inside the nucleus right here, there is, during interphase in some cells, there's a dark spot right there. That's the most active form of the nucleus. We call that the nucleolus. This is where RNA is being made. All right. And here are some pores for larger molecules to move in and out. And you're going to see what molecules move in and out. Anyway, I can even see some ribosomes on the nuclear element envelope right here. Okay, so what's the job? What's the real job of this, of the nucleus? It's to protect the DNA, just to make sure the DNA doesn't get corrupted. Okay, and so I like to think of the nucleus as being like the reserve section in the library. Anybody ever use anything from the reserve section of the library? What do we put in the reserve section? Certain kinds of books that are really expensive, or maybe there's only one copy of in the whole world. Right, so you can check that book out of the reserve section and use it in the library, but you can't leave the library with it. In case it gets lost, you couldn't replace it, or it's really expensive, so you don't want to lose it. Right, that's what the job of the nucleus is. It just protects the DNA so it doesn't get lost or damaged. Okay. All right, so small molecules can diffuse through these pores. Proteins and RNA must actively be transported through the membrane right here. And you can see the inner membrane and outer membrane in this pore. Okay. All right, so let's look at gene expression. So what the heck, I tell you what, what's a gene? Maybe we should see what a gene is first. What's a gene? A gene is a part of a chromosome. It's a segment of a chromosome. And a gene has information that can build a protein. So a gene has the ability to define how and actually when to build a protein in your body. Okay, so that's important. For instance, if a cell in your body wants to build a protein, it's got to get that information from a gene. So genes are regulated when they're turned on or turned off. And so we're going to look at gene expression. How are genes expressed? All right, well, here we have a couple different kinds of compounds. You know DNA. What's the building block of DNA? Deoxyribonucleotides. What's the building block of RNA? Ribonucleotides. And what can you tell me about deoxyribonucleotides and ribonucleotides there? They're very similar, right? They're all nucleotides. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid, right. So this is what we call the central dogma of biology, and you see it's a flow diagram, and you see these arrows right here. That means it's a one-way street, doesn't go backwards. And how many steps do we see right here in order to go from DNA to protein? Okay, I see three forms, but I only see two arrows. Okay, so there's really two steps involved in making a protein from DNA. Now, dogma is something that's really used, for instance, in more of a religious realm. Okay, a dogma is just something that you're told, and you're never to question it, you're just to believe it. Okay, but science doesn't have to do with believing something. Science has to do with what? Proving if something is true or false, right? Using experimental evidence to support your hypothesis, and then it becomes a theory. But nonetheless, I like to show this to students. This is something that you should believe. This is a good place to start in your understanding of biology. And think of it not so much just in structure, but think of it in terms of flow of information. There is information in DNA. The information tells your cell how to build itself or to build your body and how to function. So there's information in DNA that has to be converted into information in RNA. And RNA, or the information in RNA, gets converted into information in protein. Right? And the information in protein is just the primary sequence of that protein. What's primary sequence again? It's just the order of amino acids. Right, within a protein, and that's a build. What's the primary sequence, the building block for? Secondary structure, which is a building block of tertiary structure, right? And that's really the how, what is made by that protein, the function of that protein, right? That's how the function of that protein is determined by its structure. Okay, so information flows from DNA to RNA and protein, and not the reverse way. Right? You might learn in your careers a little bit later that's maybe not always true, but for right now you should say that's always true. And I would like to say to you that that's probably a really good thing that information flows one way, right? Because information in a protein can't be used to make RNA, which then can't be used to make DNA, right? And that's a really good thing because tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with feathers in a beak, right? Because you eat all those proteins, and those proteins can't change your RNA, they can't change your DNA. You're still who you are right after a meal. You don't change. Because why? The information goes DNA to RNA to protein, not the reverse way. Okay, so we have these two steps. Okay, we have these two steps, and we're going to learn what these two steps are. This step right here is called transcription, and this second step right here is translation. Transcription is converting DNA into RNA, and translation is converting the information of RNA into a protein. All right. And where does transcription, or this one right here, where does transcription always take place? In the nucleus. And why is that? Because the DNA never leaves the nucleus. If it does, it can be damaged, and that would be the death of that cell. All right, so then we have RNA. It can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm, and that's where translation takes place, in the cytoplasm. All right, so let's look at this just a little bit more. Another way of saying this is that DNA directs the production of proteins. Proteins don't direct the production of DNA. All right, now what does transcription really mean? I don't know if any of you have a dictionary handy. It's making a copy of something. So, for instance, right now, Admissions and Records has, you're familiar with this already, Admissions and Records has a copy of all the classes you took and what kind of grade you have and all that. And someone might like to know what those are at some point in time. Maybe you're going to apply for a job or another college or something or a scholarship, and they want to see, what do they want to see? What do they call that? Yeah, GPA. But they want to see a piece of paper. What's that piece of paper called? That's a transcript, right? So a transcript really is a duplicate copy, an exact copy, and you could think of it as a photocopy, right? That's how you can make a transcript. So this is transcription because what's the building block of DNA? Yeah, it's a nucleotide. I'm going to simplify it just a little bit. It's a nucleotide. And what's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide. Of course, we know they're a little bit different, but not radically different. Right, so the DNA has a nucleotide language, and RNA is a nucleotide language. So RNA pretty much is an exact duplicate of the information that is contained in DNA. All right, so again, if you think of a book in the reserve section of the library, you can't take it home, but what could you take home? A transcript, yeah, or a photocopy of it. All right, so you could say, well, this is photocopy process, but the scientific name is transcription, right? Because the language is the same between DNA and RNA. All right, then that information leaves, or RNA leaves the nucleus, and it is used to make a protein. And what did we call the second step in protein synthesis? Translation. What does translation mean? Convert from one language to another. That's exactly what that means, right? So converting information from, Farsi to Japanese, or Hindi to French, right? That is translation. And when you translate, what should happen to the information content? It should stay the same, it just changes form, right? Okay, so this is what we call translation because what's the language of RNA, or the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide language. What's the language of proteins? Amino acids. So they're two different languages, so that's what we call translation. That's how they came up with these terms, or at least that's how I can imagine how they came up with it, right? Okay. So transcription, translation. So you should know, where does transcription take place? In the nucleus. Where does translation take place? In the cytoplasm. Yeah, in the cytoplasm. Okay, so you filled in this little diagram right here. And for this class, that's a one-way street. Doesn't go backwards. Okay. Now don't forget, DNA is a polymer of nucleotides. RNA is a big, long polymer. Means it has repeating subunits over and over again. And a protein is what? A polymer of amino acids all put together by what kind of reactions? Dehydration synthesis reactions, right? Okay. All right, so I think that's what I have on this slide right here. Transcription, DNA to RNA, occurs in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. And a gene is a sequence of nucleotides. That's a set of, it's a chemical set of instructions for making a specific protein. Okay, and it makes a specific protein by these two steps right here. Translation occurs in the cytoplasm, never in the nucleoplasm. And the linear sequence of nucleotides in what we call a messenger RNA determines the linear sequence of amino acids, which make up a protein. Another way of saying this is that the primary sequence of messenger RNA determines the primary sequence of an amino acid. And the primary sequence of a protein is what? Just a kinds of amino acids that are next to each other. So think of it as a chain. And messenger RNA you should think of as a chain as well. And every link in that chain is a nucleotide. Okay, so maybe I could ask you, how many letters can be used, or how many different chains can make up a messenger RNA? How many letters? Four letters. And those letters are in R, G, C, A, and U. All right? But what are the letters in a protein? The letters in a protein are amino acids. How many different amino acids are there? There's 20, right? So there's got to be an interesting conversion process, right? Some translation that takes the primary sequence of messenger RNA and converts it into the primary sequence of a protein, right? So different words in different languages might have different number of letters, and that's the job of a translator to do that. So we're going to see how translation happens maybe today. Okay, so a gene is just a length of DNA that codes for synthesis of RNA. And that's what we call transcription. And messenger RNA carries that information into the cytoplasm, and it tells the ribosome how to make a protein. Okay. All right, so we covered that already. Maybe I should just delete that slide. All right, the nucleus contains one or more dark areas. That's called the nucleolus, or if there's a couple of those are nucleoli. These contain genes that are actively making ribosomal RNA. So the nucleolus is the most active part of the nucleus. It's the most active part of the protein. Okay. The genome right here, just a couple of terms, some terminology. A genome refers to all the genes that an individual has for a particular species. And there was a human genome project. I think it's kind of come to the end already. And so they just sequenced all the chromosomes in the human body and figured out how many genes are inside the human body. All right, so that defines the genome. And I forget how many we have. Maybe 20,000, something like that. Okay, 20,000 genes. That represents the genome. All right, but what are genes used for? They're used to make proteins through protein synthesis. So you could think of information as either being part of the genome that's contained in genes or the result of all those genes. What's the result of all those genes? It's going to be all those different kinds of proteins. All right, so you could think of the corresponding proteome. The proteome refers to all the different kind of proteins that can be produced in the human body, and that information is contained in the genome. Right, so information flows from the genome into the proteome. All right, so let's look at some of the structure of a DNA molecule. Okay, and I think we look at DNA. What's the strandedness of DNA? Okay, or the strandedness of RNA? Okay, RNA is single-stranded, DNA is double-stranded, right? And DNA is double-stranded because those hydrogen bonds between GC and AT form just right, which forms, right, this ladder-like structure, and furthermore, it can twist into this alpha helix. Okay, so what we see right here are a couple of different things. This is a chromosome. It's contained, I don't know how many miles of DNA. I just know what the total in a cell, is it one cell or human body? Uh-oh, I forgot. Okay, I think it's maybe just one cell. Oh, dang, I'm going to have to look this up. Well, if we took the DNA and strung it out from end to end, it would be 250,000 miles. It must be the whole body, not just one cell. Okay, and how far is 250,000 miles? Has anybody taken an astronomy class in here? That's about from here to the moon. So I think all the cells in your body, if we took the DNA and strung it out end to end, it would reach from here to the moon. So it's a huge amount of information. 3 billion nucleotide pairs? It's probably something like that. Yeah? Okay. So it's a big, long, stringy molecule, and you can imagine, and you only have 46 chromosomes, so divide the distance between here and the moon by 46, and that tells you how long one chromosome is. It's what? Huge, right? It's immensely long. And so if you were to try to carry this long molecule around, guess what would happen to it? Well, it'd get tangled up and it would break and snap and all that kind of stuff, and then you would lose the information in that chromosome. So what your body does is that in order even to fit it inside the nucleus, it takes a big long double strand of DNA and it wraps it around proteins that we call histones. All right, so here is a histone protein. And if we take a histone and wrap it around, or wrap a DNA around a histone, that becomes a nucleosome. And then nucleosomes can even be packaged tighter and tighter, right? So that folds DNA so it fits into a small space. But the other thing it does is that it protects the DNA, right? It keeps it from snapping and breaking and being corrupted or chemically modified. And then even these coils are wrapped into other coils. And finally, you get something that looks like this. So when DNA is wrapped around nucleosomes and wrapped very tightly, we call this condensed chromatin. This is condensed chromatin. But in order for a cell to use it, guess what has to happen to it? It has to be unwrapped from all these nucleosomes so that transcription can take place. So when there is DNA that's unwrapped from a chromosome, we call that extended chromatin. Extended chromatin. And there's a part in the cell cycle where all the DNA is in a condensed form. That's the safest form for DNA, and that happens during mitosis, when the nuclear envelope even disappears, right, and breaks down. That's a very dangerous time for all of that DNA, but it's packaged into this condensed form, so it's relatively safe. All right. So this is how maybe you should think of condensed chromatin versus extended chromatin. Let's just say that you're going to go on a trip during spring break. Where would you like to go spring break? I'd like to go to Rio de Janeiro or Bali or someplace cool. Okay. And so you have a water bottle and you got your toothbrush and hairbrush and toothpaste and aftershave and a razor and your swimming trunks. Right, and all that kind of stuff, and swimsuit, and what else? Glasses, sunglasses, hat, right? Just a whole bunch of stuff. And you walk on the airplane with all that stuff in your arms like this. Because what would happen? Well, you'd lose it, right? Plus, you probably couldn't get through security with all that stuff. But anyway, so you got all your stuff, and what do with all that stuff so you don't lose it? Yeah, you put it in a piece of luggage, right? So that's what a cell does as well. When it's undergoing mitosis, it wraps all that chromosome up and forms condensed chromatin. Your stuff is in a luggage, but when all your stuff is in a luggage, can you use it?
No.
You can't, right? In order to use it, you got to take it out, and then what could you do? You could lose it, right? So that's how you should think of extended versus condensed chromatin. One is safe, but it can't be used. The other is not so safe, but it's allowing protein synthesis to take place. Okay, so don't forget these are histones right here. And so there are some control mechanisms that will allow the cell to get at this information right here. It's under tight regulation. All right, so I don't really use these terms euchromatin and heterochromatin, but euchromatin is extended, heterochromatin is condensed. Okay, so here we have condensed chromatin. In order to go to more extended form to be used, what your cell does are enzymes that acetylate or acetylate various portions of the chromosome and it starts to unwind. And we're going to see what acetylation is. An acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment. It's a carbon-carbon molecule that gets bound to this unit right here and that starts to extend the chromatin. So here we see a nice extended region right here. So there's a gene in this region. And in order for this region to be transcribed, there is usually a molecule that has to bind to a promoter region that makes that gene available for transcription. And that molecule or factor that binds to the promoter region is called a transcription factor. And some hormones can be used as transcription factors, which then will change the behavior of this particular cell. Okay, so this is the region right here that's going to be used to be transcribed to make a protein. And when the level of that protein reaches the set point, then the cell doesn't need to make any more of that particular protein. So what happens? then this extended chromatin is deacylated and it starts to wind back up and it's put away for safekeeping. Until the concentration of that protein decreases again, then this is going to be acylated and the transcription factor will bind right here and transcription can happen once again. All right, so acetylation and deacetylation is one way to control transcription, which is the first step of protein synthesis. All right, so one gene, we used to think that this is true. One gene codes for one polypeptide chain, and actually that's true, okay, for one polypeptide chain. Each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long, but this polypeptide chain might not result in just one protein, functional protein. It might be converted into a number of different kinds of proteins or a family of proteins. All right, so at the beginning, when we were thinking of, not in this class, but in terms of genetic control, we used to think that if a body could produce five different proteins, it would have to have five different genes. Okay, one gene for one protein. And now we know that that's not really true. Right? Every gene can produce as many as maybe three or four different kinds of proteins, and we're going to see why that is. So, for instance, if an organism has five genes, they can actually make, what, maybe 15 or 20 different kinds of proteins even with five genes. You don't have to have as many genes as you do proteins. Okay, so for transcription, there is an enzyme that has to bind to a starting sequence on the DNA. And is DNA double-stranded or single-stranded? It's double-stranded, so the DNA has to come apart, right? We just call that unzipping. And so DNA polymerase does that. RNA polymerase. So what do you understand about this term right here, RNA polymerase? Well, if you ever see a word with A-S-E on the end of it, A-S-E, that means it's an enzyme. It's going to allow a certain kind of process or chemical reaction to take place. And what's a polymer? A polymer is just a molecule that is made up of repeating units, like a polysaccharide is a polymer. A protein is a polymer because it's just made out of amino acids, right? And so polymerase is an enzyme that can make a polymer. And what kind of polymer can this polymerase make? It can make RNA, right? So that's why we call it RNA polymerase. If we want to make a DNA polymer, guess what the name of that enzyme is? If we want to make DNA, we would use a DNA polymerase, right? So DNA polymerase makes DNA, RNA polymerase just makes RNA. All right, so RNA polymerase has to bind to that DNA because that's where transcription takes place. All right, near the gene, there's that promoter region that regulates transcription, and also in that promoter region, that transcription factor must bind before RNA polymerase can bind to it to make the RNA molecule. All right, so RNA synthesis. Let's look at kind of an illustration of how RNA is made. So here we have this molecule right here. What do we have? What is this molecule right here? And how can you convince me you know what it is? What is it? It's DNA. I like that answer, but let's just say, oh, I don't like that answer. Convince me. Double-stranded. Yeah, it's double-stranded. I see two strands, and I go, oh, okay. And how else would you? The base pairs, right? You see GC and AT, and you would say, well, yeah, there's thymine in DNA, and there's no thymine in RNA. It's only uracil. So for sure, this is DNA. All right, so before RNA can be made, this thing has to unzip. All right, and is that a difficult process? No. Why is that? Because there's only hydrogen bonds holding this thing together, right? All right, so RNA polymerase then binds, and it's going to look at this base right here, which is cytosine. So what kind of nucleotide is it going to put next to this one?
G.
Yeah, it's going to put a guanine. And the G in DNA is going to put a cytosine in the RNA molecule. So if we look at these, so don't forget, this is the DNA strand right here. So here we have an adenine in DNA that's going to cause the insertion of a uracil in the RNA molecule, right? So it's C and G, AU, and I don't see a T. Well, anyway, there had to be a O. Well, there had to be a T so that this adenine and RNA would be inserted right there. Right? So by base pairing rules, this is a complementary strand compared to this one. Right? So the primary sequence of DNA really determines the primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA. So what do we call this process right here? Of using the primary sequence of DNA to make the correct primary sequence in RNA. That's transcription. Right? Where does transcription take place? In the nucleus, because that's where we have DNA. That's the location of DNA. Okay. And then when the RNA polymerase finds a stop signal, then it separates from the DNA molecule, and the RNA is free to float around, and the DNA molecule zips back together again, which is easily done. Okay, so that's RNA synthesis. So when RNA is synthesized, there are three forms that I want you to know about. I see four on this slide right here, but there's really only three that I want you to know, get a feel for the definition of. Okay, and let's start with rRNA. That stands for ribosomal RNA, and that makes ribosomes. And a ribosome is just a workbench where proteins are made in the cytoplasm. So what's the step of protein synthesis that happens in the cytoplasm? What's the step that happens in the nucleus? Transcription happens in the nucleus and translation happens in the cytoplasm. So on the ribosome, that's where translation takes place. That's where RNA is converted into proteins, right? Okay, so where that happens is right on a ribosome, and it's made out of ribosomal RNA. Okay, but in order for a ribosome to make a protein, it needs the building blocks of that protein. What are the building blocks of protein again? Amino acid. So this ribosome can't put protein together unless it has amino acids, and it gets amino acids from these transfer RNA. So the job of transfer RNA is to wander around the cell, find an amino acid, bring it to a ribosome so that it can be used to make a protein. Another way that you could think of, or another word you could use to describe a transfer RNA, is you could say it's a taxi RNA. It's, what is it taxiing around inside the cell?
Amino acids.
It's taxiing amino acids. And how is it taxiing amino acids around? From some distant location in the cell to the? What organelle is it bringing to a ribosome so that it can be incorporated into a protein? And the last bit of RNA that I want you to know about is this messenger RNA. This determines the primary sequence of a protein. So just the sequence, the primary sequence of nucleotides is used in messenger RNA to actually build that particular protein. All right, but it needs, this messenger RNA needs a workbench, namely ribosomal RNA, and it also needs amino acids that it gets from transfer RNA. All right, so I'm going to describe this a little bit more. RNA synthesis in complex organisms like us, not in really simple organisms like bacteria, it's not so complicated, undergoes this kind of scheme for creating a protein. All right, so here we have a DNA molecule. It's nicely double-stranded. It unzips. And then by base pairing rules, right here is an RNA molecule that has been made from this segment of the DNA molecule. And this one right here, let's just say that this is not the ribosomal RNA or the transfer RNA. This is a messenger RNA that's being made. And you can see there's some dark segments and some light segments in this messenger RNA. And because you see different segments right here, we call this pre-messenger RNA. This is pre-messenger RNA. These darker segments right here, as far as we know, as far as I know, somebody might know, these dark segments right here really don't do much for the cell in terms of building proteins or controlling things inside the cell. All right, it's these lighter segments right here that are important for the cell. So these are like regions of just garbage RNA. So these have to be cut out of the pre-messenger RNA. These things are called introns, and the useful segments of messenger RNA are what we call exons. So we have introns and exons contain useful information. Now, it might be interesting someday to find out what these introns are really doing inside the cell, but we don't know right at the moment. All right, so what happens is that this segment can fold back on itself and base pair, and when it does, there's an enzyme that comes along and clips it here, and clips it here, and glues these two ends together via dehydration synthesis type reaction. So now you have this segment that only contains exons that have been spliced together. And these introns then are just degraded, maybe in a lysosome or something, and the building blocks are returned back to the cell. So now this is the functional messenger RNA with these intron segments cut out. And this messenger RNA can be used to make a protein. Okay, so this is just a way to describe why it is. Oh, let me go back. So this is just one gene that is making this pre-messenger RNA. All right. And for a long time, we used to think that only one protein could be made from this part of the DNA molecule, this gene right here. But let's look at this. Let's consider this. Once this pre-messenger RNA is cut, all right, it's possible to put this segment together with this one and leave this one off. All right? Or we could join all three together. That's two different kinds of messenger RNA that will make two different kinds of protein. Or what could we do? We could join this segment with this one. That's a third kind of protein that's going to be made. Right? Or maybe we just might use this segment right here and throw these other ones away, all depending on what the cell is undergoing. So, with this one gene right here, various proteins can be made from one gene. And the way to describe how that happens is by knowing something about introns and exons and how these exons can be spliced together in different ways. We call that alternative splicing. So that's what we have on this slide right here. So the human genome has 25,000 genes. Ah, that's what you were telling me. Okay, 25,000 genes. Yet it produces over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. So one gene codes for an average of about three different kinds of proteins, and the way that we now understand how that can come about is that it's accomplished by alternative splicing of exons together. All right, so go back and look at that picture. So this allows a given gene to produce several different kinds of messenger RNAs, and those different messenger RNAs are going to make different kinds of proteins. I thought I deleted this slide. Do you have this on your notes? No, good. Okay, I'm glad I deleted that slide. Okay, so here we see something called a polysome. We see ribosomes. What's the building block of these ribosomes here? Ribosomal RNA. Okay, and don't forget, transfer RNA is searching the cell and bringing amino acids to a ribosome to make a protein. We see a nice long string going through all of these ribosomes right here. And that string is messenger RNA that contains information on how to build the primary structure of a protein. And here you can see a protein as it's actually being built on these different ribosomes. So a ribosome is going to start over here near the promoter region, and it's just going to run down the messenger RNA looking for instructions on how to assemble a protein based on different amino acids. And of course, the number of amino acids gets longer and longer and longer as the ribosome runs down the messenger RNA, and then the ribosome is going to reach a stop sign, and it's going to stop, it's going to release the protein, and then the protein is in the cell doing whatever job it's been designed to do. And sometimes cells need a tremendous amount of the same protein. And so we call this a polysome, because this structure is making all of these different copies of what? The exact same protein. So this might be for secretion. Maybe it's going to end up in the rough endoplasmic reticulum and secreted from the cell. So these are the newly synthesized protein molecules. Can you see that these are longer over here and these are shorter? These just have more of all the amino acids that that protein needs. Okay, so you might ask, how does a ribosome know how to make that protein from a messenger RNA? Because how many different amino acids are there in nature? There's about 20 naturally occurring amino acids, but there's only 4 nucleotides. So how can you go from a language with 4 letters to a language with 20 letters, right? That's what translation is all about. So there cannot be a one-to-one correspondence. There can't be, say, a thymine, right? Because thymine could only code for one of the 20 amino acids, right? And what's going to happen? And adenine can code for another amino acid, and cytosine, another, and guanine, another. So with only these 4 bases, you could only code for 4 different amino acids. So that's not enough information to make a protein. So what nature has figured out to do is to use a sequence of 3 nucleotides to determine what amino acid should be placed in the protein. And we call that the triplet code. All right, so for one amino acid, it's going to require a sequence of 3 nucleotides to insert that amino acid into the protein at that one particular location. All right, so I have a couple really good slides where you're going to see how this happens. You might have to go back and listen to the lecture again, right? Because right now it might be a little abstract for you. All right, but if you look at TAC, how do you know that that's DNA or RNA? Because there's a thymine right there, so that's got to be DNA. And then here I see AUG. How are you going to know that DNA or RNA? Because there's no T's, there's a U in there, right? And of course, this also shows you the base pairing rule. So for thymine, that's going to base pair with an adenine in RNA, and adenine in DNA is going to base pair with a uracil in RNA, and of course this C is going to base pair with a G in the RNA molecule. Well, this right here in a messenger RNA is the start sign. This is the start symbol for that RNA polymerase to start making RNA. You have to have that. And then UAG is the stop sign. That's at the end of the gene, and then the ribosome knows to release the messenger RNA and stop adding amino acids to the protein. And when a ribosome runs into a sequence that's UUU, all right, this is what we call the universal genetic code. If there's ever a UUU sequence, all right, then a ribosome knows to insert a phenylalanine in that location. And this is probably one of the most fascinating slides in the whole textbook. And the title doesn't really tell you right here, but if you look in a biology book, right, it's going to say genetic code, but it's going to be modified with one other word. It's going to say universal genetic code. And universal genetic code just means that this is the code whereby which all living forms on this planet will make a protein by this code right here. So all organisms, all right, when a ribosome runs into CUU, it's going to put leucine into the protein at that location. Okay, there are some minor modifications of this from maybe one organism to another, but they're very minor. All right, so that universal genetic code is used as evidence for what? What is that used as evidence for? The unity of life, how life is all very similar and related to each other, right? So it's used as evidence of evolution, right? It's molecular evidence for evolution, that all organisms use the same universal genetic code. Okay, so this is the triplet in DNA. Here's a triplet in RNA. And in particular, we're going to find these triplets either on a messenger RNA or a transfer RNA. So these right here are what we find in the messenger RNA. So you might actually want to write down mRNA, right? mRNA. So codon refers to this triplet in messenger RNA. All right, so let's take a look at this slide right here. Okay, this is kind of nice because we see DNA, And we see RNA, and we see amino acids, and all that kind of stuff. Okay. Now, you don't have to memorize the universal genetic code. I might not even ask you on the test how to use universal genetic code, but I think you'll get a feeling for how it works right here. So here is double helix, so that's DNA, and you see thymines in there, you know that's DNA. So this unzips, RNA polymerase comes in, so here is just the one of the unzipped strands, and it's used to base pair RNA. So here is here's that thymine right here. What on the messenger RNA, that's going to code for an A, right? That's the base pairing rules, and an A is going to cause a base pairing of U. And then here's a C in DNA that's going to cause the incorporation of a G right here in RNA. And this in particular is a messenger RNA molecule, right? Only think of messenger RNA. So this is the first triplet, AUG, right? And AUG, if we look at the previous slide, is the start sign. And somewhere in the middle, it can also be used to code for another amino acid called methionine, and that was the one that has that little sulfur group on it. All right, so here is the starting sequence. We call this triplet on messenger RNA codon number 1. All right, and then following codon number 1 is codon number 2. And how many base pairs, or how many bases make up a codon? It's 3, right? So here is DNA again, CCG. That's going to make a GGC codon in messenger RNA. And then you need to have your little handbook out that shows you what the universal genetic code is. Right? GGC codes for glycine, goes in this position right here. And that code book, who's got that code book? Who's got the code book? Who's got that code book in here? What's the answer? Who's got the code book? Not only everybody in this room, but every cell on the planet has a code book. Okay, all life uses that same code. That's why that universal genetic code is amazing. Okay, so again, so what do we call this process of going from a linear sequence of DNA nucleotides to this linear sequence of RNA nucleotides? That's transcription. Where does that take place? Inside the nucleus, right? Okay, inside the nucleus. All right, and then going from, and then messenger RNA leaves the nucleus into the cytoplasm, and ribosome uses this messenger RNA and amino acids that it gets from the transfer RNA to start to make this protein. So going from this triplet code, which is a primary sequence of RNA nucleotides, to this primary sequence of amino acids in a protein, what do we call that process? Going from, that is translation. Right, and you use that universal genetic code to figure out how that works. And you don't really have to know how to do that, but it's pretty easy to do. All right, so here, what is the code for serine? Let's go backwards. What's the triplet code for serine? It's going to be UCC. Okay, and where does that UCC have to be in order to put a serine right here? Does it have to be on a transfer RNA, a ribosome, or a messenger RNA? It's got to be on the messenger RNA, right? Because codons only exist in the messenger RNA. Okay? So, I don't think this is an exam figure, but it would be actually kind of fun to maybe ask you, what is the, and let me just ask you right now, what's the genetic code for alanine? Yeah, it shows you right here. And I could ask you, what is the triplet in DNA? You would have to then do base pairing. It would be C, G, right, and then T, because there's thymines in DNA. All right, so the first time you look at this, it's not anything you've ever looked at before, but if you look at it a couple of times, it's not very difficult to get a feel for what's going on. As a matter of fact, there was a guy in Jurassic Park that even described how to do it in that movie. So if you don't want to read the book or listen to me, just rent Jurassic Park, and they kind of go over how to do this. All right? Okay. All right, so another step in protein synthesis, this is what a transfer RNA looks like. And right on this end right here, this is the end that's going to bind a particular amino acid, and it's going to bring it over to a ribosome to be put into a protein. And this transfer RNA knows where to bind to the messenger RNA. So this transfer RNA is actually going to, oh, I guess that's a pretty good slide, but I wanted to go backwards. It's going to bind to messenger RNA. So how would you describe the binding of transfer RNA to messenger RNA? It's got to obey. I'll give you a hint. How many nucleotides do you see right here on this end of the transfer RNA? You see three. How many nucleotides make up a codon?
Three.
Yeah, it makes up three. All right, so that end of the transfer RNA knows to bind to a particular segment of the messenger RNA according to base pair rules. All right, so this molecule right here, UUU, can only bind to what? It's going to be AAU in the messenger RNA because of base pairing rules for RNA. All right, so what did we call that triplet code in a messenger RNA? These are codons. So the complementary set of three nucleotides in the transfer RNA that's going to base pair properly is called an anticodon. Okay, so that's how this transfer RNA knows to put in the right amino acid in that location on a messenger RNA. All right, so probably one thing that I really would like for you to know is where are codons located? On messenger RNA. Right, and that's what's used to figure out the universal genetic code. And the anticodons are just on transfer RNA, and that's used by this translation machinery right here to make a protein. So here's a pretty good picture that shows translation. Where does translation happen again?
In the cytoplasm.
So a ribosome is made out of ribosomal RNA. There's actually two subunits that come together, and when it comes together, it incorporates a messenger RNA that goes right through that tunnel right there. And it starts at the beginning. So here we see the first codon in the messenger RNA. Here's a second. And can anybody maybe tell me what form this first codon is? What is that? That's the start signal. That should be what? Like AUG? Right there. That means that's the start sign, start signal. And then the ribosome is going to switch positions, and the next triplet code is going to be revealed. So that's going to put in a second amino acid, and here's the third one, and here's the fourth codon. So that reveals this codon. It's going to base pair exactly with this transfer RNA that's bringing in the next amino acid. And before the ribosome can slip down and read the next triplet code, then a peptide bond is formed here via what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. And after that peptide bond is formed, the ribosome moves down one more step. Okay, and then this old transfer RNA is released. Of course, this protein or growing protein is attached to this amino acid right here. And a new codon is revealed, and another amino acid is going to be joined to amino acid number 5. And this ribosome is just going to zip down this messenger RNA molecule, putting in all these amino acids in the correct location. Okay, so don't forget, the codons are on the messenger RNA, the anticodons are on the transfer or taxi RNA, and this transfer RNA knows to bind to a codon based on base pair rules. All right, so that's all there is to translation. Okay. Here's endoplasmic reticulum that's inside the cell. And ribosome will be attached to the endoplasmic reticulum. So as the protein is being made, it's directed into the cisternae of the endoplasmic reticulum. And then that protein really has only one fate, and that is to stay within a membrane-bound organelle, right? And that could be a secretory vesicle, or maybe a lysosome, or maybe even a peroxisome. Okay. All right, so the functions of the Golgi body is that the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which now has this protein in it, this protein ends up going into the Golgi apparatus where it's modified, and maybe it's modified by conjugating a simple sugar to it. We call that a mucopolysaccharide. And It's going to have different kinds of functions. It could be used as an antigen, or maybe it's just mucus, that slippery stuff, right, that kind of runs out of your nose when you have a cold. That's just a glycoprotein. And, of course, you don't want mucus inside the cell. It's going to go outside the cell because it's in a secretory vesicle. So it's going to be exocytosed from the cell because of that secretory vesicle. So the job of the Golgi apparatus is for modifying proteins that it gets from the rough ER and then packages it into maybe lysosomes or secretory vesicles. So the simplest way of thinking of Golgi apparatus is modification and packaging, okay, as part of that secretory pathway. So there are proteases in lysosomes. Don't forget lysosomes. Did we talk about the functions of organelles already? I think, yeah. Okay, that's just the intracellular digestive system. So this term right here shows you something about nomenclature as well. Oh, you don't have that one? Oh, I'm glad you told me. Okay, because I didn't want to talk about this. But I will just mention this a little bit briefly, okay? If there is an OSE on the end of a word, like glucose, what does that mean?
Sugar.
It's a sugar. OSE means it's a sugar. If there's an ASE on the end of a word, it means it's an enzyme. Okay? So, for instance, sucrose is a sugar. And what could you tell me about sucrase? It breaks what down? Sucrose. Sucrose. In particular, sucrose. Okay? And that's a sugar. All right, so protease breaks down proteins, and that's a kind of enzyme that we have in lysosomes. Okay, so DNA replication. All right, before cells divide, I tell you what, does anybody know how many chromosomes are in a human cell? There's 46. All right, and a chromosome kind of looks like this, just like that. So in the nucleus of a cell, you're going to have 46, but there's kind of a special arrangement. What does anybody appreciate what the special arrangement is? It's actually two sets, right? You got one set, 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 23, and then you got another set right here that's 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 23. The number 1s are very similar to each other. The number 2s are very similar, but different. All right, so guess where you get one set from? All right, so these are the mom chromosomes. And where do you get the second set from? Yeah, dad. So those are the P chromosomes, right? So these are the maternal chromosomes. These are the paternal chromosomes. All right. And then the job of mitosis is to produce two new cells. All right. So how many chromosomes should be, if this is mitosis right here, how many chromosomes should be in both of these two new cells? 46, right? It should be exactly the same. These are what we call daughter cells. This is the parent cell. And what's the difference between a parent cell and the daughter cells? Should be nothing, right? They should be the same. And so that means the daughter cells are identical to each other as well. You could think of these as all being clones of each other. They're just identical cells. All right, well, if in the parent cell there are 46 chromosomes, how can you split them up and still get 46 when you're done with a process? How come you don't have 23 over here and 23 over here if you're splitting this cell up? Okay, you have to make a copy of it. And that's what we call DNA replication. And when you replicate a chromosome, right, it looks like the original one plus something else on it like that. It kind of looks like that X. So this is a replicated chromosome. We could say duplicated, but we usually don't say duplicated. It's replicated. So this little segment over here is exactly equal to that one, so that when you undergo mitosis, right, it splits apart, and one cell gets one of these, and the other cell gets the other one. That's DNA replication, so that nobody gets left out of that genetic material or genetic information. Okay. So when cells divide, DNA replicates itself, and identical copies go to the two daughter cells. All right. So how does it replicate itself? Well, there's a helicase that breaks the hydrogen bonds to produce two free strands of DNA. Remember, DNA is double-stranded. So it's got to break the strands apart in order to work. Right? And is it the job of RNA polymerase to make more DNA? Because RNA polymerase makes RNA. So there's a little bit different enzyme. It's called DNA polymerase, right? All right, so DNA polymerase then binds to each strand and then makes new complementary copy from the old strand using the ATGC base pair rules, right? Because it's DNA, not RNA. So each new chromosome is composed of one new strand of DNA and one old strand of DNA. This is what we call semi-conservative replication. So every new strand of DNA, or every DNA, no, every chromosome is one strand of new and one strand of old. Right? And so the original DNA sequence is preserved. You never break apart a chromosome to make more DNA. If you were to break a chromosome apart, then you would change the primary sequence of nucleotides in DNA. And if you, what happens if you change the primary sequence of nucleotides in DNA? What changes? The primary sequence in messenger RNA, and then the primary sequence of amino acids that make a protein, and that's going to change the secondary structure, tertiary structure. And when you change the shape of that protein, what's going to happen? It's going to change the function of the protein. Okay. All right. So this is how DNA replication takes place. Here's the original DNA molecule. You can see this is DNA, of course, because of thymine. It's double-stranded. The helicase unzips it. The DNA polymerase then joins, adheres to both strands, and then it starts to add new nucleotides according to what? GCAT base pair rules. And so you can see that this is the, here's one old strand. And what is this? This is the other old strand. And then this right here is a new strand. And then here is the other new strand. So now you have a replicated chromosome. And a replicated chromosome consists of one old strand and one new strand. And the same for the other replicated chromosome. So this is, so what do we call this when you end up with one old strand and one new strand? That is semi-conservative, right? If it was completely conservative, you would end up with two old strands and two new strands. Doesn't happen that way, okay? It's only semi-conservative. And the beauty of this is that an old strand is used to make what? Is used as a template to make a new strand, right? So if you wanted to make a shirt, the same one over and over and over again, what would be a really easy way of doing that? Use a template, right? Okay, and so that's what biology has figured out how to do, is to, and notice that the DNA molecule is never rearranged, the old strand is never rearranged or broken or snipped or anything. That primary sequence is never lost, so that the new strand always comes up with high fidelity. It reproduces the correct primary sequence, right, in the new DNA strand. I suppose if it does break, then that's really bad. It's probably going to kill the cell. All right, I think we have maybe one last topic in here, and that is cell cycle, and that has to do with mitosis. You're all familiar with mitosis from anatomy, so I'm going to expect you to know this, but I'm not going to yak and go on and on and on about mitosis too much. All right, but I will want to make sure that you understand what's the function of mitosis. What the heck does mitosis allow us to do? Okay, would you say reproduction?
No.
Okay, because reproduction and mitosis kind of is the same word, right? It's the same word. It's reproduction is just making more of the same thing. But why does your body want to make more of the same thing? Or why does a cell want to make more of itself? To replace old and damaged cells, because not all of your cells are going to live your whole lifetime. As a matter of fact, there's one kind of cell line that only lives for 120 days, not very long. How many months is that? 4 months? Okay, and then dies. It's designed to die, and that's a red blood cell. So your red blood cells have a really short lifespan, and there are many of them that die every second in your body. Does anybody know just kind of a have a feel for how many red blood cells die every second in your body? About 2 to 3 million every second. So what does your body have to do? Otherwise you become anemic. Your body has to build 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second. So you're really busy in there. Even though maybe you're on vacation and not studying, you're really busy in there making red blood cells all the time. And if your body can't make 2 to 3 million red blood cells, what do you come down with?
Anemia.
Anemia, right, anemia. So mitosis is important to rebuild all those red blood cells plus other cells that your body runs out of, right? Replace old and damaged cells, that's one thing. Another thing is mitosis is important for growth, right? Two things, growth and replace old and damaged cells. Because at one point in time, you were just a single cell, right? You were the union of an egg from your mom and a sperm from your dad that formed. Does anybody know what that cell is called?
Zygote?
That's called a zygote. You were just a zygote at one time, which is just a single cell. And that's actually a pretty amazing cell, but really not all that amazing because it could never come to anatomy and take notes if you were just a single cell, right? Or physiology. So in order to grow and get bigger and develop other kinds of structures like limbs and fingers and things like that, mitosis is necessary. All right, so here is the whole cell cycle. Mitosis is a part of it. All right, here are the phases of mitosis. This is the active part of cell division. All right, and then there is a part where the cell is not dividing, but it's growing and maybe replicating organelles or chromosomes inside the cell. So during this G1 phase, this is when the cell is undergoing pretty much its normal physiology. So for instance, if this is a goblet cell in G1, what is it doing? It's busy secreting mucus, right? That's its job during G1. But it might get some instructions to say, oh, there's some growth taking place, we need to replicate this cell. So it goes from G1 to S, and here's where DNA replication takes place during the S phase. And then it comes out of S, so it just looks like what this chromatin here is all what we call extended, right? The DNA has been acetylated, so it's extended, it's being used to build the proteins, for instance, for mucus right here and other proteins necessary for replication. What kind of protein is necessary for replication? Okay. What kind of protein is necessary for replication? What makes more DNA? It's close. It's called DNA polymerase, right? Okay, polymerase. So translation is still happening right here. So this chromatin is still all extended to make DNA polymerase. And then G2, that's the final growth phase, getting ready for mitosis. So at this time, all the organelles should be replicated and the DNA should be replicated. And then that goes into the first active phase of mitosis, which is prophase and metaphase, anaphase, telophase, right? And maybe next time I'll talk a little bit about, I'm not going to talk about, I think I deleted a lot of these cells already. I mean slides. So over the weekend, make sure you can identify the different phases of mitosis and what's happening in these different phases of mitosis. And we'll do a little flash quiz on mitosis next time. And organelles.